Hello. Today we're going to be talking about F. Roger Devlin. Now, of all the thinkers I have covered so far, this one you might be thinking, who? What's that name again? Well, this book here, Sexual Utopia in Power, which was first published in 2015, is probably the most influential book that you've never read. And F. Roger Devlin, I mean, it says in the inside cover here, it says, in a decent world, Devlin would be an instantly recognizable name and a literary giant. That's what it says here. Now, because of the time that we live in, this book got very little mainstream press. It didn't really get talked about, for example, on the BBC or in universities and things like that. And yet, it's one of the most influential books that you've never heard of. And in fact, one of the authors on the back is a guy called Jack Donovan, who wrote the book called The Way of Man. And if you are familiar with that name, it gives you an insight into where the influence of F. Roger Devlin has been most keenly felt, which is online, which is a rather large space online known as the manosphere, okay, the manosphere, which broadly speaking, could be seen as a male response to the encroachment of feminism in the everyday world. Now, there are many different arguments and many different branches of the manosphere, and I do not want to reduce the worth of this book, which you should definitely read, or indeed of F. Roger Devlin's own thought, to what that has become with all of its Andrew Tates and all of the other individuals that you may or may not like. But the underlying talking points that were fed through the so-called manosphere that have become almost gospel in some of those areas, which are really very large, we're talking millions upon millions of people in these various spheres, and they've been quite influential in their own right. A lot of the underlying data, a lot of the underlying talking points do come and originate, even if those people don't know it, from this book by F. Roger Devlin. So, and when the mainstream media stages round tables and discussions on this sort of thing, they may not invite F. Roger Devlin to those conversations because of wokery and political correctness and all the rest of it. But whether they know it or not, they are responding to the talking points of F. Roger Devlin. And just because the mainstream has not paid much attention to a book does not mean that that book is not influential. And if we go back all the way through history, many of the most famous books were actually books like this one, which a lot of people had read, a lot of people in its own, but polite society wouldn't touch it. Think of Niccolo Machiavelli's The Prince, for example. Okay, now I'm not saying that Devlin is going to be a figure of the stature of Machiavelli, but what I am saying is that just because the sources of officialdom haven't touched something does not mean that thing is of no worth, or does not mean that thing is catching lightning in a bottle. And since gender wars, feminism, sex wars, and so on have become such a hot topic, this book, as the time goes on, has become something of a modern day classic, especially in those circles who would be familiar with it. What I'm doing here is I'm introducing you to some of the core arguments. This is F. Roger Devlin. He looked like that, or he looks like that, giving a speech. And he says the and what I'm going to look at is the role of hypergamy in the sexual marketplace, the unintended consequences of the sexual revolution, and how evolutionary psychology and sociology can inform what is going on. F. Roger Devlin is very interested in all of these things in this book, Sexual Utopia in Power. Now, before I continue, when I do these Great Thinkers series, if you've noticed, I do them in suites of four. I think of the week in terms of a particular theme. This week, it shouldn't, you know, if you watch yesterday on JD Unwin and Monday on Otto Weininger, it's obvious that I'm talking about sex, sexual relations between men and women, feminism, and things like this. But also I try to pick the figures and the books in such a way that they speak back to each other as well. Okay, you know, last week I talked about Jonathan Haidt after talking about Daniel Kahneman, after talking about various other people. This week I'm talking about F. Roger Devlin after we're talking about J.D. Unwin. Unwin was warning about what happens when you loosen sexual mores. Today, I'm looking at the actual consequences. So this is just a kind of pointer for people who are new to this series on how to navigate it. Okay, ideally, I'd want you to sit down and watch all four lectures together or in a row or watch them every single day. And you'll get the most out of it. It's almost like if this is an overall course, right? Each one of these weeks is like a mini course or a semester or something like that. I don't know how whichever way you want to think of it, but that is how the series is conceived. Before I get going with the 10 ideas, I will remind you it is the summer sale at the Academic Agency. That means promo code Scorcher. That means for the penultimate time, I'm going to play the ad. And when I come back, we're going to hit all 10 ideas or the most important ideas of Devlin. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Scorcher. Get it now. Scorcher. 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 Promo code Scorcher. 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 Buy it now. All right, so that was a quite long preamble to say that even if you've never seen Devlin or heard of Devlin before, you've certainly come across his ideas before. Often uncited, or often even they're not even aware that they came from Devlin. He says that the sexual revolution that took place in the 1960s has produced a quote-unquote female utopia. It was primarily an expression of female sexual desires freed from traditional restraints. Women gained the ability to mate at the top of the status hierarchy whilst retaining security and social standing. The result was that female preference became the new social order rather than any form of mutual liberation. Now, what is he really talking about? How is he coming to these conclusions? We will explain all with his concept here of hypergamy. This is the central mechanism. Female sexual selection is strongly hypergamous. Women orient towards mates of superior status, resources, and genetic quality. When social constraints are removed, this tendency intensifies rather than moderates. The structural outcome is that the minority of high-status men capture a disproportionate share of sexual opportunity, leaving large numbers of average men with little or none. Now, let us try to bring this into a concrete real-life example. Who hasn't in the current year been on a dating app? Now, does anybody imagine that the experience on the dating app is the same for a man as it is for a woman? I'll give you an example. Okay, a couple of videos back, I talked about the average height for women is 5'4". I'm 5'8", though. What's funny is that I am actually 5'8". Okay. And what that means is that if I go on one of those dating apps, obviously I'm married now, but like if I go on a dating app, how many women will state that they want to go out with a man who's over 6 foot tall, right? They have to be tall, right? The man they're looking for has to be taller than them. So poor old me doesn't get a look in because I'm only 5'8". Now, it just so happens that, you know, with my charm and other qualities, maybe I can overcome those things. Maybe I can overcome my natural disadvantage through just, you know, having a great presence, or, you know, or whatever other copes I come up with. But the fact is that that preference is hard-coded, okay, in so many women's profiles. One example. Hidden in that dating app, many women will try to ensure that there's an income, right? Many women will not date a man who has a lower income than them. Or who, or let's say they earn big, let's say they're on 50 grand a year. They'd want the man to be on 75 or 100 grand a year. They don't want the man to be unemployed, for example. This is what we're talking about as hypergamy. Okay. She wants a taller guy. She wants a richer guy. She wants a guy with high status, a guy who comes with power. Everybody said power is an aphrodisiac. So, you know, the same guy, but then she finds out, well, actually, this guy is the head of this company, right? He's not only got mega bucks, and he's got a high power job as well. And he's over 6 foot. Well, I want him. What about this guy? This is a nice guy. He's 5'5". He doesn't have, right? He's not the head of the company. He's just an employee, but he makes decent money. He makes 40 grand a year. Nice guy. He's well read. Don't want him. Or also ran. Rubbish. I want that. He's 6 foot. He's the head of the company. He's on mega bucks. I want that one. Hypergamy in a nutshell. Now, F. Roger Devlin's point, before we carry on, is that in most other times and most other places, 5'5" blokey who's a good employee and is a, you know, would make a great husband and a great father to his kids, and he gives to charity. He's a nice guy. He's a nice guy. Let's call him Dave. Dave, the 5'5" nice guy on 40K. Well, Devlin's point is that in previous social arrangements, that dude would have been married. That dude would be snapped up. Or he would have been snapped up in the old arrangements. But in the hypergamous modern environment, in the dating app environment, he's a swipe right. Or is it swipe left? I don't know. It's been like a decade since I've been on a dating app. Is it swipe right? Swipe left? I don't know. I'm going to have the whole comment section screaming, it's swipe right or whatever. But he would have been a discard. Don't like, don't want. Do one, Dave. I'm all about old Billy Big Bucks up there. That's who I want. That's hypergamy. And what Devlin is saying is that now, in the current marketplace, women are uniquely empowered to go after Billy Big Bucks and to discard poor old Dave. And Devlin, his concern is with poor old Dave over here. Now, modern society seems to like not have much use for poor old Dave, apart from taxing him, right? Apart from giving him taxes. Devlin's like, look, we need to care about poor old Dave here, because this guy is more important than you think he is. But disparaging poor old Dave and calling him an incel, that's not going to do much good. Poor old Dave the incel. It's not his fault. He's 5'5". He should be happily married with kids. What's going on? And this is basically the problem in a nutshell. So let's carry on with Devlin. This is the third point now. There is no net gain in sex for most men since the start of the sexual revolution. It is a popular assumption that the sexual revolution that took place in the 60s increased the total sexual opportunity for men as a group. This is not true. Devlin argues that sexual access was redistributed upwards rather than increased. The average man has no more reliable opportunity than under traditional monogamy. Okay, so basically, this is a kind of situation where we've recreated the modern day sultan. This is where the Andrew Tate comes in, because Andrew Tate looks at all of this and he tells his followers, look, it's me. I'm the one at the top of the pyramid. Sucks to be you. It's great to be me. It's basically what he does. It's basically like a kind of chest beating thing, you know, and the only chance you've got to escape is if you do what I'm doing. Okay. That's what he tells everybody else. Obviously, you know, he knows through the structure of things that there can only be a few people at the top of that pyramid. So he's selling a pipe dream in a way. Devlin, much more realistic, is saying, like, look, this is causing a structural issue here, because too many men are being left. Poor old Dave is being left on the scrap heap, whereas in any other time and place, he would have been happily married with kids. The revolution produced a reallocation, concentrating gains among a narrow cohort of high status men rather than expanding opportunity overall. Female sexuality is highly conditional. Female desire is selective. It is status sensitive. It is context dependent in ways that male desire is not. Right? If I'm down the Yummy Mummy Cafe there and I see a hot girl walking past, check her out and, oh, she's a bit of all right. Now, if you tell me additional information about her, it doesn't really make a difference to my assessment. Okay, you could tell me, oh, she's a bit of all right, and also she's unemployed. So what? Doesn't make, like, she's still hot, is the point. Okay, it doesn't make a difference to most men's assessment. Whereas for women, it does. It does. The additional information, the context, adds to the attraction rating. Women are a distinct category with their own patterns of attraction rather than simply repressed versions of men. When social controls are lifted, female selectivity persists and becomes the dominant organizing force of the sexual marketplace. Okay, so all of the women, all of the individual women have this hypergamous kind of status-seeking thing in there. And what it means is when you know, if you reproduce that result across millions and millions and millions of people, it means there's a whole lot of poor old Dave on 40K left on the scrap heap. Poor old Dave. That's basically who we're talking about here. But also, we should note, and this is something that Devlin does get into in certain parts, that when the girl there, the woman swiping on her app, is picking old Billy Big Bucks, you forget that because this is being aggregated, lots of women want Billy Big Bucks. And Billy Big Bucks, therefore, like the Andrew Tates of this world, kind of has his pick. He's got a lot of women to choose from. So Billy Big Bucks thinks, well, women are super abundant for me. What can I do? Well, I can love them and leave them. I can F them and chuck them, as they say. So Billy Big Bucks, he can kind of play the field. He's laughing. He's got, you know, he is living out Craig David's days of the week. On Monday, it was Tracy. On Tuesday, it was whoever. You know, on Thursday, it was Susan. Billy Big Bucks living the dream. Well, what does that mean for Tracy and Susan? It means that Tracy and Susan have not actually married Billy Big Bucks. She's not settled down with Billy Big Bucks. She has not actually fulfilled her dream of getting with the man of her dreams, because he's effed and chucked her. So the woman doesn't actually come out that well either from this. But anyway, let's continue. We get a breakdown of monogamy, which J.D. Unwin stressed so much in the last lecture, traditional monogamy functioned as a social technology, distributing sexual and reproductive opportunity more evenly across the male population through pair bonding and creating stable fertility rates. Its collapse produces a winner-take-most dynamic, the Andrew Tate phenomenon, intense competition among women, okay, for high-value men. The competition between Tracy and Stacy and Susan and Charlotte for Billy Big Bucks. Meanwhile, poor old Dave and poor old Nigel and poor old Ken, I don't know where these names are coming from, have all been kicked to the curb. They don't get a look in. They don't get a date. They don't get a wife. But also, all those women don't get a husband either, because Billy Big Bucks is doing the Andrew Tate thing. Widespread exclusion among lower status men, elevated dissatisfaction among women who expected more than the market delivers. And also, let's not forget the psychological effects of the, love them and leave them approach of Billy Big Bucks. Each time that happens to her, kind of hurts her. She goes through the pain of it. She goes through all sorts of, like, a kind of cycle of self-esteem kind of spiraling, because women are not really built for sleeping around. No matter what feminists say, no matter what the modern world says, have you ever met a woman who wasn't in some way scarred by the process of sleeping with lots of different guys? She doesn't like it. She, whether she tells herself she likes it or not, some part of her does not like it and feels bad about it. Okay. I'm not saying that should happen or is a morally normative thing. I'm just saying it is just observable. It is just observable. The women do not like to sleep around. And basically, because they go from Billy Big Bucks to Andrew Tate to the next Alpha Chad dude who through this abundance of the marketplace get to play the field. Because that's happening, she will keep on having this experience. Okay, so she actually gets demoralized. Poor old Dave still hasn't had a look in. He's starting to get demoralized too, because he's being told he's got no chance here. Got no chance. Feminism as political enforcement. What does feminism attack? Feminism attacks marriage. Feminism attacks paternal authority, the father. Okay, if you read, for example, the ancient city, the start of all political organization, going right back to the ancient world, is the father and the family structure. But feminism attacks that. And feminism attacks sexual restraint. The institutions that previously constrained female mate choice. When he says female mate choice, what he means is this a situation where the woman can kind of have the pick, play the field, and go for Billy Big Bucks all the time. Whereas in bygone eras, she'd only have a choice of Dave and Nigel and Ken. Wouldn't have access to Billy Big Bucks. What does feminism demand? Feminism demands that male resources and protection continue to flow to women, even as the reciprocal female obligations are dismantled. What were the reciprocal female obligations? Well, all of those things that men got, you know, the benefit of being in a marriage or the benefit of being in a family. There's other things that Devlin points to as well. For example, historically, when a man got married to a woman, there would be a dowry. There'd be a kind of down payment made by the father of the woman to the husband, essentially to, I don't want to say take her off his hands, but kind of to deliver her into a kind of new family unit. And, you know, this is, and there's still some element of that, you know, the father of the bride pays for the wedding, things like that. But, you know, there was actually a compensation there was a compensation for the man to take on the responsibility of protecting and taking care of his wife and also then the family unit. He was the head of it, but he also had obligations as the protector of that family unit. And for this, he would get a payment. He would have a dowry. So this is the reciprocal one part, actually material reward. Now, when a man gets married, he doesn't really get any of those perks, doesn't get any of those compensations. What he often ends up with is, you know, rather entitled individual who wants to take resources, right, from him, and then also, you know, not fulfill their part of their duties. And Devlin, and then feminism makes it such that the codes of the law, you know, disproportionately then reward women and punish men when it comes to things like divorce or divorce settlements and things like that. Devlin's thesis is that modern feminism functions in large part as the political enforcement mechanism of unrestricted female hypergamy. That whether feminists know it or not, what they're actually protecting is the ability of women to have their kind of choice of Billy Big Bucks. Okay, the fact that this does not actually fulfill or make the women happy, and it leaves them kind of with lower self-esteem and with anxiety issues and all the rest of it, is neither here nor there, because the actual fact is that all of these kind of legal enforcements and the things that feminists fight for reinforce a female hypergamous situation that has arisen since the 1960s. The utopia, the female sexual utopia, becomes a dystopia because sexual liberation rapidly generates a new system of constraints, resentments, and moral policing. Once the old rules are removed, the resulting disorder of loneliness, of declining marriage, of collapsing birth rates and fertility, of male disengagement from the system. We've all heard about men going their own way and male support groups. This was prefigured in some ways by Fight Club. Do you remember? Remember the big hug he gives Meatloaf. Remember Meatloaf hugging Brad Pitt? You know, or was it Ed Norton in Fight Club? This was kind of the first recognition, really, of something that Devlin is talking about here. Female dissatisfaction. Why are women dissatisfied? Well, she cannot secure Billy Big Bucks a lot of the time, which leaves her unhappy, especially since he's, you know, now off with Tracy or Susan, okay, leaving Charlotte sad on the side. So that is one thing that dissatisfies her. But then, you know, if she then does go for Dave, poor old Dave, she feels like she's settling, or she feels like she's kind of stepping down. That leaves her dissatisfied, or perhaps more common, she reaches 40 or whenever the time is that she is no longer fertile. She hits the menopause. And in that time, she has not managed to settle down, not managed to secure herself a partner, not managed to reproduce. And now she can't. Which also can have devastating psychological effects for women. Even if they told themselves in their 20s that they don't want kids, something biological kicks in, which is the danger, of course, of denying biology, which the modern day blank slate theorists, many of whom are feminists, love to do. Setting up women for emotional distress, low self-esteem, mental health issues, dissatisfaction, and, you know, depression, and all the rest of it. And the modern dystopian world produces demands for new forms of regulation, which are then more arbitrary than those they replaced. So, for example, all throughout history, there were courting laws There were whole sets of rites and rituals around courting, especially when sex before marriage was prohibited. J.D. Unwin, last time we were talking about. Well, you take away all of those rites and rituals. You say they're old-fashioned. You say there's been a revolution in the 1960s. Fast forward to the 2020s or the 2010s, and now you've got a new set of law. I mean, do you remember all of the rules and regulations that, you know, the change in consent, like the, all the sorts of things that feminists tried to bring in, basically relitigating sexual relations, but now done in such a way that it's so denaturalizing, so in the way, such a barrier that it puts a lot of people off even trying in the first place. And then they say, well, how are young people having less sex than ever before? In this situation, male disposability intensifies. So men, sorry to say, are the disposable sex. What do I mean by that? You're frontline cannon fodder. You, spearman. Spearman, you can be on the bow and arrows, etc. You know, you can go out and fight on the front lines. Expendable. Women need to be protected because that's the future offspring from a pure evolutionary point of view, which is what Devlin is looking at most of the time. In the post-revolutionary order, men retain all the traditional obligations to compete with each other, to produce, to protect. All of the roles that they've traditionally had are now expected of them. But the reciprocal female commitments of loyalty, sexual exclusivity have been substantially eroded. Responsibility is preserved and reciprocity is lost. And there you can see in this graphic, you know, men are expected to compete, they're expected to produce, they're expected to protect, yet loyalty is weakened, exclusivity is weakened, responsibilities are retained. And, you know, this is where there's been this kind of slow creep to try to normalize things like polyamory, right? To try to normalize, you know, the idea, for example, that it would be unfair for a husband to tell his wife that she can't sleep around. Now, that still is absurd to most people, but every once in a while it is gently pushed in the mainstream media by the BBC or CNN or something to try to make cuckoldry an acceptable practice, for example, or to normalize the idea that three, you know, a man, a woman, and her boyfriend could share to all live in the same house, for example, and things like weird kind of non-traditional arrangements of this kind. There has been a concerted attempt to normalize these sorts of things. And if you think about it, what is being normalized? Well, it's the female hypergamous. Like, she's like, well, I like Dave for his ability to look after the house and for his ability to provide and for his ability to do all of those other things. But I still like the thrill I get from sleeping with Billy Big Bugs. Why shouldn't I have both? How dare you tell me I can't have both? Now, I don't want to exaggerate. I do not want to exaggerate here. Okay, I do not believe, and I'm going to make myself larger here, because I do not believe that the situation is as dire as so many men who find themselves caught up in the so-called manosphere like to work themselves up, okay? And I do not believe that the normalization of things like what I've just described, the, you know, the polyamorous situation, has even come close to mainstream penetration. It's like there is not it is, for most people in most places in the West, that would still be an affront. And, you know, most people would say, well, no man is going to put up with that, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, that I would say is a frontier that has not come. And there's a tendency of people online to exaggerate. And I also think a lot of it is porn brain as well. I'm not accusing of Roger Devlin of porn brain. I'm saying that, you know, you can find like really exaggerated arguments. And I would encourage young men not to believe the situation is hopeless, or not to imagine themselves like, you know, oh, well, because I've read this, that means I'm inevitably going to get into a situation where, you know, I have to like share my girlfriend or something like this. That is absurd. An absurd way to think and an absurd thing to accept. Don't go that far. And I have seen, right, I just want to say, you know, this is me with my academic agent mindset hat on. And if you don't watch that channel, I would recommend you do, because it's all about self-improvement, self-transformation, empowerment, and taking control of your own life and things like that. I would just encourage, on a serious note, do not, like, remember, we're talking, these are societal-wide issues, but do not take these narratives so to heart that you believe, right, I'm never going to get a girlfriend, or if I do, she will cheat on me. I've seen young men have such awful negative scripts as a result of all of this sort of material, that they're literally just sabotaging their own lives, okay? There's nothing to stop you getting a girlfriend, okay? I just want to say that in the interest of fairness here. But broadly speaking, Devlin's point is that the responsibility for female half of the equation in many cases has been removed, or the media has been telling women, well, this is permissible and this is permissible. You know, things like Sex in the City and things like that. Where both mainstream accounts fail. So mainstream feminism denies or moralizes female agency in the sexual marketplace. It treats the outcome as purely male produced. Okay, that is the mainstream feminist view. Devlin's position is that female sexual agency is real, it is predictable and consequential, and any honest account must acknowledge it. And the conventional conservative view is that basically it falls into the opposite error, casting women as passive victims of male predation and obscuring female selectivity. So what we're saying here, right, is that Devlin says that conservatives have a habit of reproducing feminism in a kind of mirror image. Okay. And this is something else that you will witness on social media. Okay. Devlin is saying, like, look, you have to have a really honest account of this. Conservatives have a habit of what is known as white knighting, of saying everything falls on the men, of, you know, basically painting women as passive in the situation. And Devlin is saying women are not passive. Women do go on dating sites. Women do select up. Women are hypergamous. Women have actually embraced the sexual freedom that they've been granted by the sexual revolution. So let's not pretend here. Whereas mainstream feminism also denies that and places it all on men, you know, the patriarchy, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, let's continue. Reality reasserts itself. According to Devlin, human nature and the divergent sexual strategies of men and women cannot be abolished by ideology. The attempt to engineer a sexual utopia of equality and freedom has instead produced measurable, empirically documented declines. 6 decades of demographic data broadly confirm what follows from taking sex differences seriously. Family formation. We've seen a decline in marriage rates and later union formation. We have seen sub-replacement birth rates across the developed world. We have seen rising divorce rates. We have seen a breakdown in cohabitation. We have seen an increase in single parenthood. We have seen the decline of self-reported well-being in relationships between men and women, for both men and women. Women are unhappier and men are unhappier. Everybody's less happy after the sexual revolution. So the utopia that was promised has resulted in a dystopia where nobody's happy and nobody's having sex. That, in a nutshell, is F. Roger Devlin. If you cannot see how he has influenced the discourse at large, then maybe you haven't experienced the discourse. I think that he is the great unacknowledged theorist of the quote-unquote manosphere writ large. I think he presents a lot of very serious issues that society is facing, and clearly he has his finger on something, otherwise it wouldn't resonate with so many people. But also, as I said earlier, I would caution young men in particular, young men, I stress young men because you've got things ahead of you. I'm in my 40s and I'm married. I've got kid. I've already done my reproductive function. I've got a kid, and you know, I've been out there and played the field in the past. Okay. So it does, like, for me, it matters a lot less, but for you, do not take these narratives so to heart that they prevent you from, you know, having the love life you deserve. I'll just put it that way. So I do want to put that note of individual encouragement, because I don't know. I think there's a lot of nasty personalities that attach themselves to the manosphere, that feed off the insecurities of young men, and also then kind of lord it over them. I see Andrew Tate doing this, and I don't think it's a very nice thing at all. I want to try to encourage people to come up. And yes, in some ways, things have been stacked against men in the current order. But that does not mean that you can't raise yourself to the point that you can attract somebody that you deserve, and you will be able to do it if you have the right mindset. But anyway, that's more of something for the Academic Agent Mindset channel. I wasn't intending to talk about it, but it kind of occurred to me as we were there's a tendency for people to take these narratives to heart and then kind of play them out. I wouldn't want this presentation to then make you play out some of these kind of doom scenarios Devlin talks about. He is talking about society-wide. That doesn't necessarily have to mean you. Remember, the average height for women is 5'4". I'm 5'8", though, right? You can also be the 5'8", is what I'm saying. You can be the exception that disproves it all, right? For yourself, for your own life. And I think it's really important to keep on stressing that, you know, because this material can be demoralizing if you take it too much to heart. Pick up a course at the Academic Agency. It's promo code SCORCHER, 25% off all courses. I'll be back tomorrow with another video on this. Tomorrow's thinker, even more controversial than Devlin, is Guillaume Fay. He wrote a book on sex and deviance, which I'll be looking at. Similar kind of ballpark, but slightly different emphasis. We'll come to that tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.